Log Talk Radio.
This thing right here.
Yeah.
It's for my people in the streets.
Yes, today. You know, as we start the show, this one mic.
We hail. There is a pause throughout the stadium as the man sounds like he just coughed up a lung. They're looking around. The Jumbotron shows and pans the cheerleaders, and as it goes down each cheerleader's face, each one breaks up into laughter, which at this particular time destroys half the stadium. The other half is still trying to figure out what the hell just happened. Does this guy need CPR or something? And then at that particular time, I lost it. Devon Drup.
Yes. Today,
this
one mic.
Phoenix is another place. They got a great training staff. I mean, they were able to breathe life back into Shaq. And if you can do that, you know, people talk a lot about their training staff.
Love.
Welcome back to RSG One Mic. We are moving into the Cypher segment. We just had a really great conversation with Sekou. All callers and the hosts are brought to you by Carbonwell Health. Go to carbonwellhealth.com. Let them know that the Real Sports Guys sent you. We're about to go to the Cypher.
Call the Cypher.
Welcome to the Cypher. This is where we get into our main topic. And given the news that's been going on today, a lot of times we'll talk about one or two things, but we got a number of things we got to cover in this Cypher. So we're just going to be focused on top issues in sports tonight because we got so much hot stuff going on that we need to have it covered. We started off a little bit talking about the Super Bowl, and so I want to finish that Super Bowl conversation in the first part of this segment where we can really get into some of the keys of the game because the game will happen before y'all probably hear from us next time. And so I want to get a chance for myself and Hank to kind of break down what we think some of the keys are going to be. And maybe I'll start out. I think one of the things I think is going to be real clear right now, depending on whether or not Gronk plays or not, my feeling that, you know, he'll probably be cleared to play at some point this week in terms of the concussion protocol, is that the Philadelphia defense has got to control Gronk. And that happens two ways. They got to make sure that they don't let him roam free off the line. And the other thing is that the offense has got to put together some drives that keeps New England's offense off the field, you know, control those possessions. I think it's going to be critical. And that means that they got to move those first downs. They got to be able to make plays on third down. Those backs that they have to have a really good day keeping things interesting for them. And so, you know, I think one of the keys that they got to do is really got to be able to get on top of them and really try to control the pace of the game. And that's going to be very important to force Tom Brady into some mistakes. The other thing is that defensive line has got to put some pressure up the middle. I think one of the things that is difficult for Brady and most quarterbacks, particularly for Brady because he's not mobile, is pushing the pocket back into his face and making him slide and get away from that pressure and even force him to one side of the field. So they got to really start to, you know, Fletcher Cox and those guys up front have got to find a way to put that pressure up the middle and not let that pocket just set crisp. But to do some of what they saw Jacksonville doing, getting him down on the ground or knocking him down, not necessarily always getting to him, but putting those body blows on him over the course of a day. And so those are some things initially that I think are very important for Philadelphia to do to begin trying to make a case or if they want to be able to be in a position to win this game. Hank, as you begin to think about some of the keys, what are some of the things that are important that you see?
Well, you know what? I think that the recipe to stop Tom Brady is pretty clear. I think we saw Atlanta try to do it last year in the Super Bowl. You saw Jacksonville, as you had spoke about, try to do the same thing. And make no mistake about it, you're going to see that same defensive strategy that Philadelphia is going to try to do as well. The one thing that Tom Brady does, though, and what the New England Patriots do very well, is they keep that pressure on you the entire game. And what if you watch that team any time, the first half, they don't always look the best. In fact, you know, that's where these teams really, what I've watched is these teams that's played them and has really had a chance to beat them have taken their foot off the gas simply because the New England Patriots, regardless of the score, played the same brand of football the entire time. And to beat that team, I saw a game where they played the Miami Dolphins down in Miami this season. Miami simply did not take their foot off the gas. They just continued to play at that pace, and that team just simply could not come back and recover from that. That's what Philadelphia is going to have to do. They're going to have to play at a fever pitch the entire 60 minutes and not take their foot off the gas and not think that the game is over, even with 2 minutes left and they're up by two scores. That's what it's going to take. The other thing that I look at, too, is the whole Nick Foles piece. Nick Foles had an incredible game at the link last week. Really, that team looked like world beaters. I don't want to take anything away from Philadelphia. These two teams are evenly matched. They have the same record, identical record. Both of them the top seeds in their respective conference. So these are two heavyweights. You have a young heavyweight in Philadelphia, and you just have an experienced grizzled veteran in New England. The young squad is going to try to come out. They're going to try to punch him in the mouth. But they have to prepare themselves, D, for a 15-round fight. And if they come out and make the same mistakes that these other young teams have made, they're going to be watching New England celebrate again. So they're going to have to figure out a way. And believe me, Tom Brady and Bill Belichick is looking at ways. And you said Gronk is the big X factor. But the thing about Gronk is I don't think he's the X factor they make him out to be because, you know, he can't find his way. A way to stay on the field. You know, they won last year without him. You know, they won last week without him. So it's going to be an interesting game. And obviously on the New England side and on defense, just make Nick Foles uncomfortable. Make Nick Foles beat you, but make him uncomfortable. You know, that's going to make for an ugly game, but that's where, you know, if there's any advantage, that obvious advantage is going to be at the quarterback position.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that, you know, and I say Gronk in the sense that if he plays, he's always, but it's really controlling that middle of the field.
Right.
And so it was, you know, when Gronk's not there, it's Amendola, but somehow controlling that middle of the field because I think so much for them plays off of whoever's in that middle of the field. It opens up, you know, his ability to go over the top if he needs to go over the top. But, you know, whether it's Gronk or Amendola, whomever that is in that field, taking away that middle of the field and coming up the middle and forcing Tom to play one side or the other early, get rid of it early. I think it's something that they're going to have to really try to do and beat him around. I think that's going to be important, like you said, and Foles has got to make some plays. And the fact that the running backs, Ajay and Clements and those guys, have to be able to make plays in the running game, but also in the passing game to help keep drives going so that, you know, they create some single coverage on the outside so that there's opportunities to get downfield. And so I think those are some of the things that I have to look at. If you were going to make your early prediction, who are you predicting to win Super Bowl?
Well, listen, I'm going to tell you what I look to see. I look to see this game really lean more towards Philadelphia early. I look for Philadelphia to really come out. I look for them to be on fire. I look for them to try to hurry up and really try to punch New England in the mouth. But what I look for is that fourth quarter. I look at the fourth quarter, not just any other fourth quarter. I look at it as a legacy fourth quarter. I look at it as Tom Brady and Bill Belichick and this group of Patriots, their last hurrah. And I look for a very, very close game. I'm looking for a one-score game. I'm looking for maybe a field goal game. I'm looking for a late score game. But I look for New England until somebody does it. I'm looking for New England to take this game and win back-to-back Super Bowls.
Yeah, I'm with you. I hate to go anywhere else, but after seeing what Atlanta did last year and seeing what New England did in that situation with Atlanta, I just can't bet against New England.
No.
I think Philadelphia is sneaky good.
Yeah.
And I think they're even more sneakier good without Wentz, because in some ways you don't quite know what Foles can do, but Foles has had big games before. You wouldn't be surprised if he threw four touchdowns. He's just that kind of kid. You just never know what's going to happen in the moment. Philly just kind of been sneaky tough the whole year. But there's something about the GOAT. I've been hard on him in terms of his social issues and stance and everything else. But if I'm just going to be a football person and be honest about that, they got good balance. They got enough balance to win. And I think he's highly motivated because I think for you, he doesn't know how many he's going to get. And every chance he has, he's going to take advantage of it. And you got to take it from him. Like you said, that fourth quarter, and I'd even say how they come out, I think it might be tough during the first half. How they come out in that early third quarter? How do they set the tone that they're really in the game? And then you're right. Are they ready? Are they going to play to win in the fourth quarter, or are they going to try to play not to lose in the fourth quarter? And most teams make a mistake against New England when they try to play not to lose. They end up losing. It's almost like they go into this prevent mindset that doesn't pay them well, doesn't do them well, and they end up just letting them get you by a nose. And so
right.
We're looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a great week of kind of watching it build. But, you know, obviously Hank and I are believing that New England has got it. And so
before we move on, I do want to add this, though, that there were some takeaways that from this playoff year that we need to talk about, and that is that we saw a Jacksonville team that I think you and I are both very excited about, that we can't wait to see mature develop and see what kind of championship pedigree is that team going to have. I think you've seen a Minnesota Vikings team that, you know, if they make the right moves at the quarterback spot and can stay healthy, you know, what does that look like? This Philadelphia team, you're looking at some teams now that really look like there's some torch passing of the torch. You know, the New Orleans of the world, the Green Bays, those teams. You're starting to see the Jacksonvilles. You're starting to see the Minnesotas and the Philadelphias and the Rams, you know, come up. And now it's like, now you're starting to see this next wave of NFL teams that we can start looking at and who's the next dynasty. So I think that's the fun part of what we saw as well this year.
Well, one of the things that we're gonna try to pay attention to it. We're excited about it. Obviously, Hank and I will have a lot to say once Super Bowl's over. In our next podcast and kind of reflect on what we had a chance to see, and we'll kind of sum up that NFL season. One of the adjustments Hank and I had to make, and part of it is because our hometown team was involved in the blockbuster, and which shocked me. I got in the car and I was like, what? So here it is. You have Bryce Johnson, Willie Reed, and Blake Griffin sent to Detroit for Tobias Harris, Avery Bradley, Boban Marjanovic, a first-round draft pick in 2018 and the second-round pick in 2019. Wow. I mean, I was just caught up, and you know, we had just had a conversation about it. I felt like, you know, you had the big blow up between Houston and the Clippers, but it felt like the, even with all the injuries, the Clippers are finding their legs. Reports are that, you know, this has Jerry West's fingerprints all over it. I don't know what it means for West and Doc Rivers. It's been a lot of speculation about them not really getting along, you know, a lot of tension. You got Lawrence Frank is part of that, and it seems like they are sending a signal that they're rebuilding. You know, but Tobias Harris is, you know, having a great season. You're still looking at the Clippers probably making some more moves as well here over the next right here for the trade deadline in terms of, you know, being able to move some players. But Griffin coming to the East, I got a text from my guy Hammer. Hammer's like, what do you think? I was like, Blake Griffin in the East is big. He has some struggles out West, but Blake Griffin in the East can be dominant, can be a changer in the East if they use him correctly as well. And I think the sneaky part of that trade, because I like them coming out, is Bryce Johnson. I think Bryce Johnson, if used correctly, has a lot of potential. I think this kid, I watched him at Carolina. I think he has a lot of potential. But when you heard about this trade, man, I know you right there, you know, the airways have got to be going crazy down in southeastern Michigan.
Oh, it went nuts. See, here's the thing. You got to understand that the Pistons right now is not getting a whole lot of press, okay? You have some very, very frustrated NBA Detroit Pistons basketball fans around here. Stan Van Gundy, who is the president, GM rather, and the coach of this team, for the last 3-4 years, and we haven't seen this team really develop. You have you have the face of the team in Andre Drummond, and you're trying to put some players around Reggie Jackson and some players, and you're looking for this team to start to make a move, and they hover around the eighth spot in the East, and they go on these ridiculous losing streaks, and it's just. People were around here are really starting to get kind of frustrated with the Pistons. So then all of a sudden you look up and you're thinking that, okay, you're going to try to, you know, sneak in under the radar on the playoffs around here for what? Because you're not going to beat anybody, blow this thing up, you know, get Van Gundy out of here and try to build this basketball team the way it needs to be built. Well, lo and behold, we look up, and to me, on the surface, it looks like a Stan Van trying to save his job kind of move. Okay, you get a Blake Griffin. First of all, that you hopefully that'll sell you some tickets to the Little Caesars Arena, get more people out there to come see him and Drummond play together. And then you talk about Bryce and you talk about the other players that came along in that. And like I said, on the surface, it doesn't really resonate too much outside of the fact because Tobias Harris. You know, those guys, we weren't winning anyway. The Pistons weren't winning consistently enough with those players on the team. But what I think when I kind of read the tea leaves and the reaction is, you know, the average fan is, okay, now you're giving away draft picks. You're giving away a first-round pick for next year. Okay, we don't know what that pick is going to be. And then you give away a pick the following year. So what are you really? You're mortgaging your future for a team that's hanging around eight. All right. So I think that the name Blake Griffin is going to turn some heads. But I know that Blake Griffin spends a lot of time, you know, on the shelf with injuries too. So we'll have to wait and see. I don't think that it's mixed right now as far as the fan base right now. They're mixed because a lot of people are already. Disenchanted with Stan Van and what he's done with the Pistons. I think it's going to be exciting to see Blake Griffin, provided he can stay healthy. But the bottom line is, what are you trying to get out of this Detroit with this trade? What are you hoping to accomplish? Are you going to be able to keep Blake Griffin, and for how long? And then what other moves are you willing to make yourself a contender? And do you think you can contend with Cleveland and Boston either this year or next year? So, you know, there's a lot of questions around why the Pistons are doing what they're doing.
Yeah, and I had a chance to see the Pistons in Chicago when LaVine made his debut game, his comeback game. And, you know, they lost on a last-second play. And the difference I could see, the Pistons had some strength on the wings down low, but other than Ish Smith, the point guard, they needed a dominant. That was the difference in that game, was the point guard play. And I think Ish Smith has the ability to be that point guard. But I think what Blake does bring to them that's been a feature for him this year is his passing off the double team. Because they got some shooters, but they didn't have anybody that who could really draw the double team and open them up so that they could get some free shots. So I think one of the most important things about them getting Griff is his the way in which he plays almost his point forward at times and draws and become a much better passer and create open shots for people. I think you're right. I think Van Gundy's trying to figure out a way to kind of save what he has and not have what happened to Doc Rivers happen to him. Meaning, you know, at least they might take away that, either tell him to either go up to the president's booth or find somebody else who can do that and take away a little more of that power and control that he has. And, you know, I think for him, he's real nervous because that I think that's why he felt like he had the exit in his two previous locations, Orlando and Miami, because he didn't have the kind of control he thought. And I think that was one of the reasons he took it. But when you have that control, you got to do something with it. And when I look at that team, I watched them. They got a lot of talent, but they've never had a floor general. You can tell they're missing. And even the young Bulls had that floor general, had that space. And you can tell the difference when you have somebody who is controlling the tempo in the backcourt. And so if Ish Smith is going to be that person, he's going to get those minutes.
Right.
And that's what they need because they got the wings. But I think the one thing that Griff does give them is that when he gets the ball in his hands, he can also distribute because that's one of the things that they were missing. And people are going to get some open shots because they got shooters. So we'll see how this plays out. On the Clippers side, that is interesting because it sends so many signals. And it feels like they slow walking Doc. It's like a slow death. You know, his power slowly going. You know, he's playing with these G League guys. He's winning. You trade his best player. You're going to make some other trades. You're going to play with these young people. And, you know, Avery Bradley and Tobias are great players. It's not like he can get anything back. But it really feels like it doesn't feel like they're all on the same page out in Clipperland. It feels like the owner and Jerry West is on the same page and Lawrence Frank. But I don't know. I don't know how much it feels like Doc is part of that conversation. And in some ways, it feels like he's experiencing the reason why he left Boston. Now he feels like he's going through it again. And some of that's for him to blame because he had control and he kept, you know, people debate the way he was using it, his general manager control and president's control. So the Clippers side of it, they got a lot, but I don't know what they're going to do with it. You know, I trust Jerry West, but it seems like they got a lot of issues there in the front office. You got Lawrence Frank, who's an ex-head coach, as the president. You know, there's a lot of just changing dimensions there that I don't know where that's going. And I don't know I don't know what else to say about it. It doesn't seem like Doc is going to be there very much longer.
Well,
by his
does.
Own personal choice.
But you know what? But it does. But you questioned anyway when Chris Paul was not back with that team. And now I'm not surprised. If you've really been paying attention to the Clippers, I'm not surprised that they moved Blake Griffin. Again, Blake Griffin, when he is healthy, is a game changer. But his health, and he has missed significant time over the course of the last three seasons. All right? That trade in and of itself really benefits the Clippers, in my opinion, far more than it does the Detroit Pistons. Okay, it helps the Clippers, in my opinion, far more than it helps the Detroit Pistons because they got a draft pick and they got, you know, they got two good ball players that's going to help that team. okay, and that's going to play. It's going to play some significant minutes. Now, the thing is about the Clippers, and you and I talked about this team last year. I told you they look like a throwback team as far as how their lineup was set up. However, they did not do what they needed to do to keep that team rolling the way they're supposed to.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of it is, you know, I mean, the hard thing about it is Chris Paul is not, you know, he didn't lead them in the way he needed to lead them. I mean, I know there's a lot of complaints or whatever, but Chris Paul's playoff success wasn't there. And I know they had injuries. They had Paul hurt 1 year, Blake hurt 1 year, but you know, he wasn't, you know, you know, in some ways they let him down, and they let Doc down, his stars let him down, and they just could not get over the top. They had that, what, 3-1, 3-2 lead, 3-2 lead with a lead in the fourth quarter against Houston, and folded and then lost. And then, you know, they could have been playing Golden State before they won that first championship. And so that was an opportunity for them to get over the top. And so in some ways, you know, that goes differently. Doc put them in position to win, but at some point your superstar's got to win it for you. And I think they just lost steam after that. They could never get over the top. And Doc wasn't ever able to add some of those young pieces. I think one of the things that Marcus said really good that changed with Jerry West coming in here was that Jerry West, one thing you can't say, he gave him some innovative young people to come into the fold. And Doc kept going back to that, you know, that old veteran mentality of recycling players when he wasn't, you know, being a little bit more creative about where he found the talent to actually add some energy, similar to what Golden State. Golden State has all these young guys that they find, whether they develop them and they energize them into the lineup. Same thing with San Antonio. And that comes with the player development part. And I think that's what's so hard about being both the president and the coach. And so they find themselves in this spot. The one thing about the Detroit trade, if Bryce Johnson is what I think he could be, that Detroit trade becomes a nice trade. I do think the Clippers, if use it, definitely could win that trade. But I think it could turn out to be a trade that was mutually beneficial for what they needed at the time. If Bryce can add that extra element of depth that can get them going into the playoffs in a way that I think he can develop, that could add something to the Detroit side of the equation that can be very good for them. So we'll see where that goes. We'll see how that evolves. But that's something that happened that we felt like we needed to talk about. A tease that I want to put in for y'all from the NBA thing. Next week, Hank and I are going to upstage Steph Curry and LeBron. We're going to do our own NBA draft. We're going to do it live, though. So this is a little teaser. In our next podcast, Hank and I are going to do our own live all-star draft. It's going to be like the playground. You ain't going to have to speculate who gets picked last. You're going to know who gets picked last. And we apologize right now. And you can decide whether or not you want to come or not. But we're going next week. But with everything going on, but we're going to do that before the All-Star weekend. We're going to have fun with it. Stay tuned for that next podcast when we do our own NBA All-Star draft, Hank and I, and we're going to have fun with it. But you will know which guys get picked last. We believe in being transparent. As we go into the second part of this, you know, Hank and I, as y'all know, are natives of Michigan. And the other thing you do know is that on the RC platform, we spend a lot of time talking about the world of intercollegiate athletics. Because of our backgrounds, a lot of time, intersection of education and social issues. And though you might have to have been under a rock to not know what's going on at Michigan State University. with Dr. Nasser in that case and the many victims and kids to young women, but just the culture of sexual assault, rape, abuse, that I would say Michigan State serves as a wake-up call for what is happening on a lot of campuses, and particularly this intersection between intercollegiate athletics, money, power, and how process and decision-making is happening. Magic Johnson, who is Michigan State's probably most famous alum, came out very strongly about his reaction. You know, most people thought, some people criticized how long it took for him to come out and react about that people should be held accountable and fired if need be. Most people by now are aware of Coach Izzo's exchange with a reporter from ESPN and really appeared to be frazzled, but at the same time, in some ways, made it seem like he was not aware of some of the circumstances, particularly with one of his assistant coaches, when that assistant coach actually was living at his house. This has so much to do with power, privilege, abuse, and just exceptions tied to a lot of the issues that we've talked about on this air. And, you know, I thought that, you know, it would only be appropriate, you know, because this is who we are, Real Sports Guys, that we spend a little bit more time talking about this. And for Hank and I, given that this is our home state, and we'll fully disclose, you know, we grew up in the Ann Arbor area, but this is different. This is not probably bashing Spartans. In fact, you know, Coach Izzo's one of my favorite coaches. And I'm upset with the way he's handling this. And as you find out a lot of this stuff, D'Antoni is that typical football coach response to this stuff of power and privilege that I think is just unacceptable. And so there's a lot that goes on with this. But as two guys who grew up in that state, you know, for the Big Ten Conference, given what happened with Penn State, now at Michigan State, not to say that this isn't happening all over the country, but these are two highly visible activities that's happened in the Big Ten Conference. When you think about what happened at Penn State, and to still see that this is going on, even after what happened with Sandusky, to still have made these decisions makes it even much more egregious. So, you know, Hank, I know that you and I have talked a little bit offline, but, you know, just your initial reaction to the, you know, how this thing has been unfolding.
You know what? This thing, I don't think a lot of us realize the severity and the gravity of this until the ESPN report came out. You know, there was a lot of talk going back to last year about Dr. Nasser and what he did. But unless you had an opportunity to read some of the gory details of his actions, you really didn't realize, you know, what sort of monster that he is. Now, you know, we knew that he worked at Michigan State and he worked for the United States Olympic team with the gymnastics team, but we didn't know the level of again, how just absolutely gross this was. And to just bring everybody forward on that, he was sentenced to 175 years by a Michigan judge who basically said to him during his sentence that I have just signed your death warrant. So you take that news, and then all of a sudden what that did was it opened up Michigan State to a lot of criticism and a lot of scrutiny that a lot of us simply did not know. And when I mean a lot of us, just your casual fans and or just people, sports people, you know, just you didn't know a lot of what was going on. Now you find out. Now you kind of knew, D, but you didn't know. So, you know, like for an example, last year Michigan State's basketball football team went 3-9, and there were several players kicked off the team or because of misconduct or violating team rules. Okay, so we knew that, but what we didn't know was how long and how deep this went. And so now you have us talking about it this week, and all of us, and I'm a Michigan fan, and you know, you guys who listen to the show know that. But I'm deeply troubled by what was going on in East Lansing. And you're hearing narratives like, you know, if this was a program that really was watching what's going on, they would have handled it differently. But Michigan State, not knowing how to handle success, was letting things go and all this other kind of stuff. All that stuff is speculation, all that stuff is conjecture. But it is concerning when you have Mark D'Antonio come on and you have Tom Izzo come on and they're saying these things like, you know, we're handling everything right. There has to be a time when you have to humble yourself when you don't know all the facts. And this needs to be one of those times, okay? You have the whole nation looking at Michigan State, and you brought up Penn State. And what you saw with Penn State was a whole institution covering up stuff. And then that word, lack of institutional control, okay? And now you got Magic Johnson saying, if anybody knew what's going on, everybody should be fired. Well, I got news for you. If those guys knew what was going on, it was covering up, that's going to be a bombshell. And it's going to be an embarrassment, not just for Michigan State, but for the state of Michigan. Trust me. And, you know, it's not something that I really would like to see happen, you know, to that institution. Not that way. You know, you would hope that, you know, if you've got college-age kids and they want to go to Michigan State, that your daughter is going to be safe if she steps on that campus.
Yeah, you and I have a number of friends and folks who, particularly folks of color. There's not a lot of predominantly white institutions where people have a serious allegiance to. Michigan State's one of them. When you talk to people of color who are alums, and it's always an example of people who have pride in their institution. And some of the folks I haven't talked to yet, and I know they have a deep reaction to some of this craziness that happened here. But this thing has gone all the way up to the NCAA. In fact, it's been reported that Mark Emmert was made aware of this back in, I believe, 2010. They were notified about several of these incidents that occurred at Michigan State. And this is where, you know, the whole power dynamics, money structure element can come in, this idea of process. You know, I just went through Title IX training. It's very clear about how you report this and who should be involved and who should be, considered and how folks should be notified. And it's a very set process. And so if they set up their own process in addition to that, to keep it from going into that process, there's going to be problems with that. But then to know that the NCAA, and this is why I tell you, I always say, you know, faculty are part of the issue. Mark Emmert is a former president, senior leadership, CEO of a major university, former member of the faculty, former tenured faculty member, right? And I always say that faculty members are key to this equation. Mark Emmert started his career as a faculty member, rose up through administration, became a president, chancellor of a major university, then went on and became director of the NCAA. And so he should understand these things. And this kind of plausible deniability and, you know, the language we're using in response to this, you can't have this many things happening and not have any people know. I mean, I'm on a college campus. Ain't no way in the world. You can't have it and not have these people in power positions not know. And so I think one of the challenges we got here is that in the middle of all this, you got the NCAA already under scrutiny because of what happened in basketball. You already got Congress looking at what's happening in terms of control and what's happening in terms of everything else. One of the things I said early on in our beginning of our RSG podcast process is that the one thing that could begin to put its thumb on what's been happening in college sports in terms of revenue and out of control is if you had congressional intervention.
Right.
And between this thing that happened in basketball and what's this right here, is the kind of stuff that gives mothers, fathers, daughters, community members up in arms, that elected officials have to respond. It's one of the reasons why the Attorney General in Michigan is responding. Part of it's a political response, but common folk have said there's a problem with this. And if you ever got congressional involvement, not too far behind that is some type of legislative oversight. And it's going to be interesting to see how this thing evolves, because these things have happened pretty close together. To have someone like this, where it's reported, the number of times it's reported, this is not like once or twice. This is in significant numbers, and no one did anything. But right. Yet you're going to y'all suspend or a player if they sell their jersey to someone to get money for food. Is that kind of balance that is crazy or imbalanced? It tells you where the power and interest in the structure is. Some of these incidents that they describe happen with football. You and I have been around this space, man. We've been around this growing up. Some of the stuff that they describe and that some of these players were doing, and nobody. But then when you have an assistant coach as well, man, that you talk about lack of institutional control. There's nothing greater than that, particularly on the heels of Penn State. This is going to be
absolutely right. And you know,
see how this goes.
The sad thing about that too is that, the sad thing about that whole piece is that if you go back and you think about some of these incidences or some of these claims, and I can tell you, where players were allowed to play, they were allowed to play. They you didn't know what happened with them, and these situations were serious. They were absolutely serious, especially with that football team. I mean, I can just recall a year ago, there was all kinds of stuff coming out of East Lansing on top of the Larry Nassar case. I mean, a whole lot about players being taken off the team, this, that, and the other thing. And then you have a football coach say something like, well, this is the first time this has happened. You know, you don't do that. You don't do that. And then they try to minimize it by saying, oh, well, this happens on every college campus in America. That's not fair to those other institutions that's doing it right and really trying to protect their athletes and their students. You know, this is a mess. And this is the second time, unfortunately, in the Big Ten, okay? And so I'm not going to be surprised. And if Michigan State, I know I heard the governor is also talking about getting involved in this as well, D. So, I mean, this thing is going to get worse before it gets better. And you're right. And I will say this, that, you know, to Michigan fans out there and stuff like that, this is not one of those times where you play. You know, I'm gonna say this is not no time where you play because you see a rival falling short. This ain't one of those situations. This is very serious. This is very serious, especially for everybody in the state of Michigan, because it's an embarrassment. It's very much an embarrassment when you have an institution of higher learning that cannot control or will not control what they know is absolutely and blatantly wrong for a dollar, to the point where young women are being assaulted, you know, right there on campus, and their rights are not taken seriously. I just think that's wrong. And I'm with Magic Johnson. Something needs to be done about that.
And, you know, and I applaud the faculty, staff, and students. You know, this is what I love about our college environment and our students is they will stand up and speak truth to power. If y'all been on up these campuses, I spent my life on college campuses. What I love about our students and our faculty and our staff, and particularly in some of these major public universities, is they will speak truth to power. And the fact that they are coming out and holding the administration accountable, you know, Coach Izzo, you know, I've loved watching you, but you make a lot of money and you got to answer some questions. At a certain point, you can't be feeling like you know that you're being put in a higher spot when you reaped a lot of benefits for some of these young people and folks that are being coached. Like you owe the people, and especially the people of Michigan as a public university, the time and effort to be a straight shooter to come to do this, because people have invested their kids. We talk about the way in which sports have drawn people to come to universities and places and recruited kids to be there, to be in a place that they are not safe. And, you know, as a public figure on that, you got to be the one who's toeing the line and holding that expectation for the university, because you are that public figure. So for me, you can't be asking like, you can't be acting like you're being put off and put in a position when somebody's asking you some legitimate questions, given what's been going on. And then, Tony, you can't be treating folks as they stupid. Sometimes these folks be giving answers like they Trump. You know, like we just supposed to believe what you're saying. Like, look, there's nothing that goes on in your program you don't know about. You're not a major college coach and not know these kind of things. These things come right to you. These kind of incidents don't get passed on to the assistant coach. The head coach know about it because the AD know about it. And so for you to act like you're going to kind of pass these things on, it's important. And I think your message real clear about, you know, Michigan fans and other folks in there. This is not about rivalry bashing. This is happening on everybody's campus, and don't act like it ain't happening on yours. And this is, people got to really try to clean out their closet. But it tells you how far we've come for the money, for the bag. Because this wasn't swept on the rug just because it was swept on the rug. It was swept on the rug because of the bag. It was swept on the rug because college sports has become a really important fundraising vehicle. And you're not going to upset that. And to the extent that you would allow very vulnerable people to continue to be abused. And folks who came forward to feel like they're going crazy. I mean, in this case, you had fathers committing suicide, kids committing suicide. Like that's the outcome of people's lack of institutional control, that lives are lost.
Right.
That's hard to stomach as someone who's been a college administrator for almost 25 years. Right. I've been through enough of these cases with a lot of young people on both sides. These are not easy things to get through when you have to work with people and families and pain on all sides of these issues. But you have to be committed. And I know there's a lot of people over in the student affairs side of things at MSU who been trying to say things for years only to be overpowered. There's probably been some people who've been fired because they raised some issues and people pushed them out. When you talk about the collateral damage on this stuff, there's a lot of bodies you're going to find when they start digging deep. So it's going to be interesting about where this goes. And, you know, we're going to keep a post on this. We also will be bringing some folks on as we can periodically to share their thoughts, some experts, people who know this much deeper than myself and Hank. So, Hank, let me switch gears a little bit on here, because we're going to come back to this topic a lot over the next couple of weeks, because I think this is something that's going to linger for a while with us. When we think about kind of like future of athletics, when you think about, I'm projecting, you know, this is one of the things I've been projecting in one of my, you know, real good guys I know, Sean Fraser, who is the AD at Northern Illinois University. One of the things I appreciate about Sean is that Sean is he's someone who understands the developmental side as well as the fundraising side. One of the things that I'm seeing that's going to be very important when people are starting to look at athletic leadership as these things keep blowing up is that a lot of the ADs come from the business side. A lot of people who end up in the ADC are people who don't have student development backgrounds. They know how to raise money. And I think I'm interested in thinking about, because of the level of liability that's coming out of these kinds of things, what that's going to mean for athletic leadership. That, you know, unless you can find someone, and not to say Sean hasn't gone through whatever he is, I haven't had a chance to talk to him, but one of the things I can appreciate about him and some of the other ADs I've met who are in that space, there's a number of ADs who not only are good fundraisers, but they understand this student athlete development issue. In fact, they really push on coaches on this area. You know, what do you see that going? Because I think that the leadership model in athletics is going to have to be addressed if it's going to be sustained long term.
It is, but here's the thing, okay? When you start talking about big time college sports, that's not going to change overnight. They're going to always find somebody who knows how to run a business to take over that. We have seen that where the athletic departments have flourished, okay? I'm sure when you look at Michigan State, and you can even look at Michigan several years ago, they flourished. They made the money they wanted to make initially, okay? What happens is everything else starts to fall apart, okay? The business aspect flourishes well, but now you're talking about state-run institutions of higher learning, okay? You're talking about schools, all right? And that's where they fall apart. What's going to have to happen is that we start talking about oversight. It's like, okay, you can't just let the almighty dollar run your athletic department. What you've seen with more successful athletic departments is that you've got somebody who understands both sides of that. They understand the business aspect, but they also understand the athletic piece of it. They also understand the collegiate piece. But that's not going to happen overnight, because a lot of these institutions right now, a lot of these athletic departments need to get the big deals. They need to get the big facilities. They need to do all these things, too, because recruitment is a big thing. And so in order for them to recruit properly, they need someone who knows how to help build buildings, who knows how to improve facilities, and all this sort of thing. And until you get that piece done, are you going to be able to go back to the old school, old-fashioned athletic director that runs his athletic and runs his or her athletic department like it's supposed to be run, where you are watching, you do have oversight on what's going on here. You have oversight on the academic side of what's going on with the student athlete. A lot of that is lost, too. We haven't talked about that. A lot of that is lost, the business aspect. But until these buildings are built, until these grants and all these things are rewarded, you're going to see this time and time again, because you can't do it all. If everything is all business oriented, then you're not going to get into the student athlete. They just become, unfortunately, a byproduct, and these things you're going to see again. And then, you know, as time moves on, you'll probably see some sort of oversight first, because right now there's so much money involved. They want the institutions to take care of it themselves. But that may change if this continues to go on. Again, what you see is the schools that figure it out have somebody who's got that balance of business and has a collegiate background, an academic background, understands how collegiate institutions run from that side. And until that changes, this is going to continue.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you might see is, you know, Ohio State and several universities have the model where the academic side of this stuff is handled in the provost's office. The advising is handled somewhere else. I think Florida State has a model they've been moving to where some of these things, so these issues get moved up either through the provost's office or a central office that's not handled within the athletic department to address the stuff around academic issues and students' academic choices and separating some of that stuff out. So you might see a hybrid model that folks might move to, that it, because there's now there's more liability in the central administration office if you don't take care of things. And so I think there might be some evolution of that. You know, we might bring some folks on who could probably speak to that issue. I think that'd be a good issue for us to dig in. Well, let me drop the mic. You know, one of the things that I had a chance to watch a little bit this weekend is Tiger Woods. And part of it is this idea of the process and developmental and also finding peace. You know, I think for Tiger these past 4 or 5 years has been really a journey to peace. And for the first time, you can see that he is comfortable. It's not about winning championships, but he's just comfortable in life. And I think that might add up into him having some success here in the near future. And I think that's something that we all have to reflect on is where is that point where we all are at peace? And so here we wish that you be at peace, that you find whatever it is you want to do, and that we want to thank you for being with us here on The Real Sports Guys. Till next time, from Hank and Devon, this is RSG1 Mike.
Lock, Talk Radio.
This thing right here.
Yeah.
It's for my people in the streets.
Yes, today. You know, as we start the show, this one mic.